In fact, did you ever hear Chicken Sound? You know how chickens go? Anyway, I guess we better strike off these soon before it's too late. Okay, boy.
I know the rift is in your eye. What are you trying to defy? Do go on, I see the way. Why don't you see it? Why don't you see it where you are? Why don't you see?
Welcome to the Cinematic Void Podcast. Cinematic Void is a cult film series that hosts screenings in the Los Angeles area as well as virtually. I'm your host, Jim Branscombe, and joining me as always is...
Hey, it's Nick Vance, Paranormal Futures on all social media. You can find Cinematic Void on the World Wide Web at cinematicvoid.com as well as Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and all major podcast platforms.
Hey, what has Nick been doing?
Man, nothing exciting. I've just been working, man. What the fuck else? I don't know. My car is breaking down. It's falling apart.
That car is not that old, though.
It's a guy like 40,000 miles on it. It's done. Set it on fire, dude. Fuck that thing.
I mean, yeah, just torch it.
No highlights, man. No highlight reels.
Okay. Well, I'd say there's at least one highlight.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. We did our first Cinematic Void podcast intro for a movie.
Oh, shit.
So you want to talk about that, at least?
Let's talk about that. So we did... Old Jim here had me up on stage to introduce the bloodletting screening last Monday. I was projecting. And for those of you who haven't seen it, I think did we talk about bloodletting here on the past? Like, did we actually do an episode on it?
We have not. When we were talking about the lineup, we talked a little bit about it. And maybe some of that was included in the intro. We also had a lot of jokes and kind of...
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of cool to subject a whole movie theater of people to a movie we watched in high school a lot.
It's a crazy movie. I haven't watched it in a while, but I was kind of like, before going into it, I'm like, oh man, like, you know, this is a bad movie, whatever. But like, after kind of like watching it again and like hearing everybody having a good time down there, you know, I think I'm back on it. I'm back with bloodletting. We're friends again.
I mean, it played really well.
It really did. People were actually like really stoked on it, and came out of the theater like repeating the jokes and shit. I mean, you know,
I mean that's kind of like what I want out of a Cinematic Void screening. Like, obviously, you know, show a lot of bigger movies, and like booking this, I knew it wasn't going to be a numbers grabber, but I feel like the people that took a chance on it had a fucking great time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, just every fucking like snappy line of dialogue, the exploding baby, the dick biting, like all that stuff played fucking huge in that room.
Here's a little inside baseball. I'm a fucking nerd, and sometimes when I project things, like, either, I don't know, I just kind of want to know what if anyone either has a comment on like the projection aspect of it sometimes, like, so like, I, you know, if you go on Letterboxd like right after a film plays, you can see 10 people just left a fucking review, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I did that after Bloodletting, and like a bunch of people, like there were even people saying like, you know, I'm so glad I finally got to see this, like I never thought I'd get to see this on the big screen, you know, that kind of thing. So like there were some people there that had already seen it and whatever, and hell man, it is even on like fucking Tubi right now, so
wow,
take the chance and fucking watch that insane movie.
I mean, it's very 90s.
Yeah.
Like, there's no way around it. It's just fucking 90s Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good thing. You know, it's... I kind of miss that aspect of regional filmmaking. There's still people that kind of, like, tap into that. But it's kind of a thing that's been erased, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, there was a big market for this stuff in the 90s. Like, direct-to-video, DVDs, VHS, and, like... You know, there's still people who do shot on video stuff, but just not as prolific, and it's not as, like, out there as it once was.
Right on.
So it's kind of a good way in, like, it's a different look for Cinematic Void. Because, like, I remember when I told you, it's like, yo, I'm going to do Bloodletting because it's in the ACFA catalog.
Hell yeah.
So, you know, again, not a audience, like, not a lot of people came out to it. So, but, you know, part of it was, like, you accidentally sent Monday. It was actually on a Thursday. It was on the 29th at a 10 p.m. slot. Yeah. So it had some things going against it. Like, you know, it's Leap Day. And, you know, people celebrate Leap Day by, I don't know what people do for fucking Leap Day.
Yeah, 2 days ago to me feels like a week ago.
You know, I
it's crazy. It was a long week.
You know, I honestly, it felt like a Monday because, like, the only time I associate doing screenings is Monday.
Yeah.
So it might as well have been a Monday.
Yeah, true.
But it's like, you know, 10 p.m. and then we got out and, like, but, like, it was nice for everyone hanging out in the lobby and then going outside and just kind of talking about it afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people were genuinely stoked. And, you know, you don't get that always when you show, like, a bigger movie or whatever. And I kind of want to talk about some of the other screenings, which, you know, I do want to say before I switch gears here is that I think we should do more of those. We should have more Cinematic Void podcast intros here and there.
Right on.
You know, I know I had to go up to the booth and talk you into it, and you're like, nah, I'm not going to do it. I'm just going to stay here. But, like, nah, you came down. You had a good time.
It was cool.
You know, it was fun. It was a nice, different way to introduce a movie. And, like, the fact that, like, a lot of people are like, oh, where was this all my life?
I was very close to coming up on stage in that brick wall.
Oh, the brick wall from the fucking psychic intro, like, we did.
Like, grabbing all the different props backstage. which thing would be the funniest thing for me to run out in? You know, what if I'm dressed as the black glove killer, you know?
Yeah.
Just come running out like that.
I mean, Deanna did leave a graveyard of fucking props back there that just continue to grow.
But
you had options.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's fun, and we should do it again for something else. Maybe something that, you know, gets a little wider audience. But I think doing this kind of opens the door for me to do more things like this in the future because, like, you know, the thing about film programming, not everything's going to be a hit.
Yeah.
And, like, I knew going in that it was just, like, it was a tough sell because, one, it's, you know, DCP, which always gets a knock in L.A. Two, it's shot on video. Three, a lot of people hadn't heard of it because they weren't cool in high school. I want to talk about some other screenings I've done at the Los Feliz 3. I don't know. Did you project any of the other one of these?
What else was in the series? Remind me.
It was Hollywood 90028 and The Chase. You didn't do either of those. I didn't think so, but I figured I'd ask before I, like, keep diving in because, like, I want to talk about these because this is another little programming tip because you never know what's going to actually do well. So when I had these booked, I was under the impression Hollywood 90028, which is a rarely seen exploitation movie, newly restored by Grindhouse Releasing, I thought I'd do between 50 and 80 people. Just because of the nature of it. Now, I had played the New Beverly in a really ragged-ass, like, pink print maybe a year or so ago. So, I was like, you know, I didn't know what kind of audience to get. And, like, Bob Murawski was like, yeah, man, I thought only 15 people were going to show up to this. Like, thanks for the vote of confidence on your movie, Bob. But, like, but it ended up selling out. Like, out of the blue. Nice. Like, it just kept picking up traction and, like,
was this a new restoration of this or something?
Yeah, it's brand new.
Okay.
Like, I think it played Stige's Film Festival. I don't know if it's played anywhere else. This was definitely the LA premiere or West Coast premiere.
Cool.
So, but, like, had two of the actors there, Christopher Augustine, who was the lead guy in it. And I wish I could talk about the ending because I don't want to spoil it because the ending is one of the most insane fucking things ever. Like, I need this movie to get out there a little bit more because I feel like you have to sit through the movie and catch the ending unexpectedly.
I had honestly never heard of this until you had programmed it.
It's not a lot of people have.
Yeah.
It's like, it's a deep, deep, deep cut, but I think it's becoming a hot title. Like it's tapping into a weird zeitgeist right now. They got a Blu-ray coming out eventually, and I think that Q&A I did with Christopher Augustine and Gail Davis. Gail Davis had a smaller role; she played a hitchhiker in it. But you know, they hadn't seen each other since, like, the '70s, and, like, Christopher Augustine used to be in a well, he I, he 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 ended up getting out of acting really and became a professional drummer. He drummed for Captain Tennille, Elton John. Like, he was in a band called Elephant in the 70s, like a heavy like psych rock band.
Crazy.
So like, and that dude, he was like in his 80s and he was like fucking just on fire. Like, you know, he just, that guy just had it. And like, I don't know, it was a fun screening. And like, again, I wish I could talk about the ending, but I don't, the ending needs to be seen. Because my friend Jackson was there and he was getting up to go to the bathroom right before the big climax in the movie. And I just like stuck my arm out and stopped him. And he's like, what? I'm trying. And I was like, no. Do not go to the bathroom right now. And then the ending happened. He's like, oh, thank you, man.
Yeah, you totally saved the entire experience for him.
I mean, I would actually done that for like anyone. Yeah. Because like,
yeah, because, that's great.
Because that movie's a real slow burn. And if you just go out and use the bathroom right at that moment, and then you come back and the fucking movie's over.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's no end credits. It's just like this crazy fucking ending. And then the lights come up. So when we did the Q&A, there's a little bit of a clusterfuck to get it ready. But like, you know, it's fine. It's
mm-hmm. Because there's no crawl or anything.
There's no, yeah. It's just a long shot. And then the movie ends and you got to throw the lights up.
Cool.
And the reason why I'm pointing out that this one sold out. So I finally got to do The Chase, which has been a bucket list screening for me. And I was for certain it would sell out. Now, the screening itself did well.
I didn't project it, but I did inspect the print. So I did get a nice look at that. So that was very cool.
That print was fucking nice. Like, it, you definitely see some like barely like some surface scratches, not the green kind, but just like, you know, mm-hmm. regular wear and tear. But like, it probably played a couple times theatrically, and whoever has that print in the Academy took care of it. I was talking to the director, Adam Rifkin, who I've had like in person before for Detroit Rock City. I was like, is this the first like repertory screening of The Chase? He's like, I think it might be.
Damn.
So, but I, and this is something I learned. Now, there's a lot of 90s nostalgia going on, but I think that nostalgia starts at like 97, 98 Ford and not 94 when The Chase came out.
Yeah.
But I also think there's some other contributing factors. Like, this was a movie that probably you and I saw a lot on regular TV or HBO or whatever back in the day. It just played all the fucking time.
Whereas, like, HBO or maybe even Comedy Central or something.
Definitely played Comedy Central. Definitely HBO. Probably played just, might have played just regular, like, Fox cable TV or something like that. Because this movie isn't available on Blu-ray currently. It's kind of in this weird fucking limbo. That just, I don't know. I feel like it's kind of weird to say a movie from 1994 is kind of lost, but like, there's a good portion of diehard people there really excited to see it. And like, you know, like I said, it's not a bad crowd. It was a packed house, but it was a sellout. And I thought this was a slam dunk.
Did you ask how many people hadn't seen it?
I did. And like, it was a good portion of the room.
Yeah.
Kayla, who does social media for the Cinematheque, saw it for her first time. She's like, this is my favorite movie now. And like, you know, watching with the audience, like The Chase fucking smokes because it's just fucking great.
Yeah.
And like, you know, did a Q&A with Adam Rifkin, who wrote and directed afterwards. And like, it was a fucking blast of a Q&A. You know, he's funny. He's got great stories. Talked about how Charlie Sheen threw a piece of steak at Chrissy Swanson one night at dinner. It's just... But he also revealed some other things, like Bill Paxton was originally supposed to be the lead.
Mm-hmm.
And Fox was like, you need a bigger name. Or that, not Fox, because like, this was, technically The Chase was an independent movie, but Fox agreed to do negative pickup, which means they'll pay for it after the movie is shot.
Okay.
So it was an independent production that still got picked up by a studio. He's like, because Bill Paxton was in The Dark Backward, which is like Rifkin's like, magnum opus of like just weird, crazy, just great fucking movie.
Yeah.
And he said, like, however, they let Bill Paxton be in True Lies, which came out the same year. It's also a Fox movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, like, Ray Wise, who's in Twin Peaks, he played the dad in Twin Peaks, Laura Palmer's dad.
Yeah.
Leland Palmer. He's like, he wasn't the original choice. He's great in it, but the original choice was to be Charlton Heston. And they're like, oh, I don't know if he'll fit, but they let him be in fucking True Lies. So, like, yeah, James Cameron stealing all his shit.
Yeah.
But, I don't know. It was a great screening, but it also just kind of gives me perspective, like, in the film programming spectrum. Like, I thought something that, like, just was so ingrained with me nostalgia-wise, like, I thought there would be more people like me. And there was a good bit, but, like, you know, The lesson here is that the movie that is like super obscure but might be building some traction.
How do you think this would have fared had you not had Rifkin out for any particular reason and you had just programmed the film, being as though it is kind of lost and that sort of thing? I don't know. You know what I mean? I mean, like, do you think you still could have been able to turn it into an event like you did without the guests?
That's a good question, and I don't really know. I mean, I think Hollywood 90028 benefited from having the guest, and it's a restoration, and also, like, Grindhouse, the distributor, was fucking promoting the shit out of it, too.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, The Chase is ready for not that anybody thought it was bad in the first place, but, like, it's up for a reappraisal or up for a rediscovery, right? And but, like, is it already on the cusp of being so? Or, like, Or am I suggesting that you're the one that's bringing it to the people? I don't know. That's not where I was going with this, but, you know, I'm just kind of curious.
Honestly, I mean, unless someone else does The Chase at some point in the next year or two.
Also, I hope that they do, by the way. I'm sad that I didn't go now.
I mean, the difficulty was, like, I tried to do this last year, and Fox, which is now owned by Disney, said there was no materials. There was no prints, so it took a little bit to go find where our print was available. Thankfully, mm-hmm. there was two at the Academy.
Oh, nice.
I don't know which one we got, but, like, the one we got looked fucking nice.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the thing is, it's like Disney doesn't allow you to play one of their films or Fox title unless there's a DCP or a 35mm print.
Mm-hmm.
They don't let you play Blu-rays and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So there's no alternative to playing it. And because, like, you know, not every movie theater is going to have access to an Academy print. Mm-hmm. So unless Disney strikes a DCP,
yeah,
it might be harder to see. So, like, this might be just like a one-off thing. I don't really know. It could be a thing where, like, you know, maybe I'm talking like it did bad. It did really well. It was a fucking fun screening. Yeah, but, like, yeah. I guess I'm just looking at it for, like, you know, I rarely show stuff based on nostalgia. Although, funnily enough, I did twice this month. Show Bloodletting and this, which were based on big things of me and my, like, you know, teen years.
I think I may have even pay-per-viewed The Chase when it came out. If you remember back when you would pay-per-view a movie, which is basically the same as, like, you know, fucking Amazon buying Prime. and streaming a movie now, you know what I mean? But yeah, it's funny.
It's actually like the same price point, really. It's like, it's like anywhere from like $4.99, maybe $9.99, depending. But, like,
yeah,
it's the same thing. I saw The Chase in the theater. I rented it on VHS, and then just any time it happened to be on TV, no matter at what point in the movie was, I just start watching.
Yeah.
Because it's just that kind of movie. But I also, like, there's a bunch of people there that were my age or older that didn't see The Chase.
Oh, nice.
And I don't know, it's just wild. And, like, I don't know, it's just, I hope it kind of gets reevaluated because, like, you know, I think Adam Rifkin's an underrated great director. He's got a new film that's going to be coming out some point this year that he did with Malcolm McDowell. It's a Western.
Oh, cool.
So, and, you know, he did the last movie star with Burt Reynolds. Like, Rifkin makes fucking great movies. And it's just weird that, like, one of his bigger, like, studio-released movies just is, like, in obscurity.
Is that common with Fox stuff in particular?
I think.
And do we have to delete that?
Nah, we'll just leave it. It's just, like, It's. I think part of it is, like, Fox owning or Disney owning the Fox library is that it's a learning curve for Disney because, like, there's obvious things that people are going to want out of that Fox catalog that Disney is well aware of. But, like, you know, when you throw a curveball like The Chase, you know, they might actually have a print. They just might not know where it is because no one has asked for it in, like, forever.
Crazy.
You know, there's another movie that's in the Fox archive that, like, I would love to screen, but I don't know if they have any materials for it, which is Kenny and Company by Don Coscarelli.
Okay.
And although more interesting to think about is that movie might have actually fell out of the Fox rights and, like, Don might have actually got the rights back.
Okay.
So that's another question that I don't really have an answer for. And, like, you know, this is the kind of things you have to deal with film programming. Like, the fact that there's studio movies that are falling out of rights and then just adding to a weird limbo space.
Mm-hmm.
Lastly, just to kind of move on. So we've talked a lot. And this isn't a talky episode, but I guess it is talky because the movie we're going to be talking about has a lot of talking in it. A lot of freeform talking, which we just did, right? You didn't say that very enthusiastically, but we, as promised, we've been talking about doing some Robert Altman movies, solo episodes, for a while now. And this is going to be the first one. I think we're not going to do them back to back. We're just going to kind of spread them out through the year because they're kind of long, some of them. This one was kind of long. And, you know, this is going to be the first one. We've previously talked about Images on the Giallo Jason episode way back, whatever episode that is. But for this one, we're talking about Robert Altman's 1975 movie Nashville, which is one of my personal favorites. Nick just watched it for the first time. So we're going to take a commercial break. And when we return, we're going to be talking about Robert Altman's Nashville here on the Cinematic Void podcast.
Now, country love songs. 24 original hits. And an exclusive TV offer by Teledisc. A great double album set, Friends. By the artist who made them country classics, Willie Nelson.
On my mind.
Tammy Wynette.
By the time.
Not available in stores. 17 world famous recording artists in all. In a fantastic two record set or long playing cassette. For only $14.95, enjoy Charlie Rich, Lynn Anderson, Lee Greenwood, Kenny Rogers, Johnny Cash, Ray Price, Don Williams.
I beg your pardon.
To order Friends, call toll free 1-800-554-2700. That's 1-800-554-2700. Or send $14.95 plus $4 shipping to Friends, Box 989, Department A, Hicksville, New York. Or call 1-800-554-2700. Satisfaction guaranteed or your money back.
Welcome back. We are going to be talking about some Robert Altman movies here on the Cinematic Void podcast. And for this episode, we're going to talk about one of my personal favorite Altman movies. It might actually be my favorite Altman movie, which is from 1975, which is Nashville. It was written by Joan Tewksbury, who also wrote Thieves Like Us for Robert Altman. She also appeared as an actor in McCabe and Mrs. Miller. And a lot of the things that happen in this movie are based on incidents that she witnessed while she was in Nashville. So, got some realism in there. There's so many fucking actors in this movie. I don't know where to begin. So I'm going to name a lot of names here. Might mean something to you, might mean nothing to you, because like there's 35 principal cast members in this movie, which is a lot. I mean, it's an ensemble piece, but some of the people you may or may not recognize in this movie are Keith Carradine, Lily Tomlin, Ronnie Blakely, Karen Black, Shelley Duvall, Henry Gibson, Ned Beatty, Jeff Goldblum, Keenan Wynn, David Hayward. And, you know, that's some of the main players. And just for fun, because they happen to be on set during the production of this movie, Elliot Gould appears as Elliot Gould, and Julie Christie appears as Julie Christie in Nashville. The cast is absolutely insane. For those who haven't seen Nashville, which is kind of weird because we're going to talk about it, and you probably should, and there is going to be a spoiler in here, a thing that, like, I withheld from Nick because I knew it would make the difference for him. And we'll get into that when we get into that. Basically, over the course of a few hectic days in Nashville, like, you know, there's a bunch of musicians and political figures. Well, there's one political figure that wants to, like, you know, trying to run for office. It's a lot of loose threads that kind of tie each other together as the movie goes. Some are looser than others. Some are tighter than others. Some are unexpected, which we'll talk about, obviously. A couple things I want to hit upon before you and I start talking about it. Most of the actors had to write and perform their own songs in the movie, which I think is really fucking cool, and I kind of wish more movies did that, in a way. But also, I guess you would need a different caliber of actor that could, like, write and perform a song, which is...
That's actually pretty crazy.
Yeah, I mean... Maybe Nashville's the exception to that rule, and the only one that can actually pull it off.
I mean, was that part of the audition process as well?
I think it was.
Then who was the actress that the whole bit was that she couldn't sing?
What's her fucking name?
And was that written in just because they wanted her to cast her and she couldn't sing?
I don't think so. I think they intentionally, like, you know, had her, like, yeah. There's someone in this movie, and I can't remember, had singing lessons just to kind of, like...
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. There's a lot going on. But, you know, also, like a lot of Robert Altman movies, while there is a script to this and all the plot points were dictated in the script, a lot of dialogue was improvised.
It's career enthusiasm.
Yeah. I mean, before that. And, you know, there's lots of overlapping dialogue and there's lots of, again, Altman likes to throw a lot of threads out and some are loose, some are tighter than you think. It's the kind of thing that, like, kind of pays off with repeat viewings, but obviously if it's not your style, you might not be coming back to it. Another thing is that the country music scene, specifically from Nashville and maybe across the country, was very unhappy and disliked this movie. They felt like Nashville was kind of making fun of them or didn't respect their musical heritage. Altman actually chalked it up that they were basically mad because he had the cast write their own songs and do their own music and then use any established like Nashville acts to do those songs in the movie.
A lot of this film in general, I love like all the, I mean, it's so of its time, and especially like culturally. I grew up like in the early 80s when I was growing up, like I grew up in a very like, I don't know if redneck is the word I want to use, but like, you know, my family was fucking country, dude, like really country. Like we vacationed in West Virginia country, and you know, I grew up on fucking country. Like my first concerts were like going to see George Jones and Conway Twitty and Hank Williams Jr. and all these motherfuckers, right? Like it's fucking sick. But so I feel a lot of nostalgia when I watch this, even though I wasn't quite there in the 70s yet, right? But also with that said, and feeling like I have some kind of like true connection to it culturally, it doesn't feel like it's making fun of anything to me. It feels pretty fucking authentic.
And I think that's part of it. I think where they think it's making fun of them or the perception is because a lot of those songs are dead on to a lot of the tropes that are in country music songs.
It's a trope, but it's not, it doesn't seem, to me, it doesn't seem like it's being like funny it's a little too on the nose maybe for them, but I don't know. You know, I think maybe its charm is that it's walking that line so closely that you can't tell whether it's taking the piss or not.
And I agree with you. I don't think it's taking the piss because, like, I think it's like a, you know, probably maybe the, I think the main issue is like you had a bunch of, how to put it, I guess I'm just going to put it in as Civil War terms. You had a bunch of Yankees come to fucking like the South and like do a country music movie.
Yeah.
And that's probably some of that. But like, I think over the years, this movie has been reevaluated by country artists and musicians in general. So it's looked upon in a different light then, because, you know, let's just kind of talk about, like, this movie was a big hit for Paramount Pictures and Robert Altman when it came out.
Mm-hmm.
It got a ton of Oscar and Golden Globe nominations. I think the only one they really won for was the Keith Carradine song, I'm Easy. That won a Best Original Song Oscar. But this movie was a big...
Which is actually, it's pretty crazy if you think about it, you know what I mean? Like, it almost feels like it's something that could have been played on the radio at the time too.
Yeah, I mean,
you know,
I think that's maybe. I think that's the thing is like all those songs feel like real songs, and I think they just hit that. You said nostalgia, like, you know, I didn't grow up in the 70s either, but like, you know, my mom listened to a lot of country music, and like obviously there was a point in my life I would listen to a lot of Johnny Cash and mm-hmm. Hank Williams and Waylon Jennings and like Loretta Lynn and, you know, Patsy Cline or whatever, just a lot of country music, and I still like a lot of that stuff. And it just, like, it feels very authentic. It sounds like a real fucking country song, where, like, there's a lot of movies you watch where, like, they make music for a period or something. Like, you know, there's, like, I want to say, like, 1920s movies, like, more meant now, modern, not movies from 1920s. But, like, when people go back in the past and try to recreate music from those eras, there's just something that's not there.
Yeah.
Where, like, all these songs feel like they're fucking staples of fucking Nashville.
Did you ever get into MTV's The State? Do you remember that show?
I remember The State, yeah.
Like a sketch comedy show. They had wanted to make a physical release of that for years, and they couldn't because of all the right, because it's all just like MTV 90s alternative music peppered all throughout the show, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when they went to release it on DVD, the guy, Craig Wedren from Shudder to Think, he wrote fake 90s songs for the entirety of the show and like put them, you know, so that's what the DVD is like all these fake songs. And it's the same sort of thing where they sound so fucking authentic. Like you would never know that someone was like creating fake songs, and it's kind of even poking fun at, you know, the popular songs of the day.
I mean, but that makes sense, because you know how many movies and TV shows are actually tied up because of music licensing.
Totally.
Which, you know, has nothing to do with this, because all these songs were written specifically for this movie.
Totally, totally.
But, like, you know, I mean, it's just another point, because, like, you know, if you watch a 35mm print of Return of the Living Dead, you get that damn song. You watch it on your fucking Blu-ray, that damn song is gone.
Oh, right.
There's a couple other movies, like Last American Virgin. There's a couple songs that are in the 35mm print because it's cleared for that, but on home video, nope.
Right on.
But, I don't know, I mean, so Nashville it's a movie about politics, it's a movie about music, it's a movie about people, and it's also could be easily looked at as a long hangout movie that's really about nothing. And I've seen this quite a few times over the years. This is your first viewing, and, like, could you just kind of talk about, like, your first impressions of this as it's going? Because I know there's a certain point where, like, it kind of shifted and kind of made more sense for you.
Well, let's be honest here. We did watch this together, and we did watch this actually in two sittings. It's 3 hours long, and we watched the first 2 hours last week. Mm-hmm. And then we got together today, and I actually threw it on from the beginning this morning and just kind of let it rip as I was kind of cleaning up. And so, you know, just like last time when we watched it, I wasn't really paying attention. That's not entirely true. But so by the time you got here, we were kind of, it was kind of getting right back to the point of, like, where we had left off, more or less. I definitely feel differently about it than I did at the 2 hour mark, you know? But yeah, it's fucking long and it's fucking about nothing. And, you know, I had a lot of opinions those things are still true. It works because of the way that it comes together in the end. And I had a feeling it would, like, I don't know. If it didn't, I was going to have a real fucking problem. I can tell you that much. I think maybe you'd kind of spoiled that for me. Last time you'd maybe just kind of quickly just mention, like, that either that it wasn't to come together or that it was going to particularly come together for me. Maybe you even had said that and you weren't wrong.
I mean, I think the reason why, because I could tell when we were watching, when we were doing the first sit down of it, and also, in your defense and my defense, we started watching it late, which was probably not the wisest thing.
Oh, that's right. We tapped out at like midnight.
Yeah, because when I came over, I came over here like at 8,
mm-hmm.
and had we started, it'd been done like 10 or 11, but we fucking dicked around, shot the shit for like an hour and a half before we actually started the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And we might have had some coffee. Actually, no, we were drinking beer, so that was like...
Yeah, we were fucking tired, bro.
Yeah, we might as well just ate a loaf of bread with that beer because we were making ourselves sleepy.
Yeah, man. It's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. Someone mentioned me a week or two ago when I told them that we were doing this. They were like, I really like Nashville, but it's like the kind of thing I have to be in the mood for. It's like, it's like with a lot of other movies, I could just sit down and watch whatever, but like, I got to be in the right mood to sit down to see Nashville. What do you think about that?
I think it's a fair point. I think it's a fair point for like a lot of Robert Altman movies, because also, as much as I love Robert Altman, there's Robert Altman movies I'm not going to go out of my way to watch.
I mean, you got to be in a fucking mood to sit down and watch anything that's 3 hours long.
Yeah, I mean, but like, it's a very specific style. Like,
yeah,
you know, I remember there's a online interview from the 70s where John Carpenter is talking shit about Robert Altman, where he calls him like pretentious and like masturbatory and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, on one hand...
Right, it's like I can't exactly argue it.
I can't argue it. On the other hand, it's just like, not to get in a pissing contest here, it's just like, you know, the thing with Altman is that the way greatness comes out of his movies is just because it's organic. And while there's things planned, it's just like, you know, I don't think, you know... I know there's been other people that have tried to do the Altman formula, probably more like the 90s run of like The Player and Shortcuts and stuff like that, where I think by that point, things were more redefined, where like, this is very loose.
Yeah. But about two-thirds of the way in, I'm like, there better be a fucking tragedy, and all the main players in this story better be connected to it somehow, or I'm fucking rioting.
And there was.
And it paid off.
And you can add it to your Letterboxd list of, you know, active shooter movies.
There you go. Fuck yeah.
Which I that's why I didn't want to tell you that part, because I wanted you to be surprised.
Yeah.
Because, like, you know, my first impression of watching this movie, and this has been, I think, first time I watched it was in a movie theater, Bruce Holchek. I think we saw the Charles Theater, because they did a Robert Altman, like, retrospective, like, maybe 2008, 2009.
Okay.
I actually have the schedule for it. Like, I know we saw Brewster McCloud, and I'm pretty sure we saw Nashville.
Cool.
And
I gotta see. Do you own Brewster McCloud?
I don't own it. Warner Archive put it out on Blu-ray. I've been holding out because I've been thinking, like, eventually Criterion's gonna snag it and put it out, since they put out other Warner titles.
Gotcha.
I'm surprised they haven't yet. I mean, Brewster McCloud's a lot of fun, and it speaks to Altman, like, you know, oh, you have a big commercial hit with MASH. What do you want to do? I want to make a weird movie about a boy that flies around the Houston Astrodome with fucking wings, shits on people and kills them, and you have the Wicked Witch of the West say the N-word.
Man, I gotta see this.
Yeah, it's it's fucking insane. Like, no, there's no reason this movie should exist, and it fucking exists. It's fucking just, it's bonkers.
Yeah.
And, like, it's the most uncommercial thing you can make after having a big fucking Hollywood hit. And that's kind of what I like about Altman, because he just, like, would go, like, so far. And, like, in a weird way, Nashville kind of, like, it's, is this a mainstream movie?
I wouldn't think so, but I don't know. I don't know what the climate was like in 1975.
Well, yeah, because, like, 75 was the year Jaws came out.
I must remind you that I believe that the 70s is the worst decade for film.
You're so fucking wrong. But, like, it's my favorite decade, you fucking asshole. But like,
yeah, nah. Jaws, which I, again, like, I like that you try to call me out the other day in a group of people. You're like, he probably doesn't even like Jaws.
I mean,
like, come on, dude. Everybody likes Jaws. You're a fucking, you actually are a dickhead if you don't like Jaws.
I mean,
come on.
You're such a curmudgeon at this fucking point. I don't know. I know you like Jaws, but, like,
that's just an opinion of an actual insane person.
I was just waiting for it. I just wanted to see if, like,
I just can't even back that up. I can't even back that up as a bit.
I wanted to see if you would fucking double down on it, and you didn't.
It's nice. I appreciate you throwing me the bone, but I just couldn't even. I was also just like, it was midnight. We're not doing this right now.
You don't have time to fucking get into, like, Jaws disparity. Like, I don't know. But no, like, 75 was kind of like with Jaws, and then, like, a few years later, Star Wars was kind of the change of, like, how Hollywood was making movies. Because you got to think, like, that period, like, from 69 through 81 was, like, the peak of, like, you know, American studios making crazy kind of art house movies.
Yeah.
Like, also, like, there's exploitation movies and there's horror movies. Like, but it was just a different era. And the fact that, like, yeah, if something like Nashville come out in 75... and it did well. And
yeah,
then you also have Jaws, which fucking, like, slaughtered its competition.
Right on.
And I can't think of two movies that are, like, that vastly different. And it's a thing about, like, Robert Altman, because, like, I feel like you're either all in or all out. But, like, because I know a few years ago when we watched Images, you weren't that big on Images, were you?
I wasn't, but I'm ready for a revisit now, you know, for it. I think that was my first Altman.
If it was your first Altman, it's kind of a weird starting point for Altman.
Yeah.
And, you know, and Images is completely different from this.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, like, maybe Images, and now that you've seen Persona and love Persona, like, Images is going to hit different. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
With this,
well, I'm curious the differences between even Images and Three Women then. You know what I mean? Since you say Persona, he was just very,
I mean,
influenced by Persona.
I mean, a lot of filmmakers were, like, there's a whole strand of, like, the Repulsion Persona, like, children,
mm-hmm,
that, like, even pop up today. Like, those two movies are so ingrained in cinema in a way, mm-hmm, that, like, you know, a lot of people still pull from them, and they're from, like, the fucking mid to late 60s.
Yeah, man.
But the thing about, like, Altman, and particularly Nashville, is just, like, there's a... there's a certain, if you're going to tackle a movie with that big of a cast, you're going to have your cast write their own fucking songs and perform them and sing them. And just like, you're going to have sequences where it's just people fucking like singing one or two songs back to back. And there's some incidental shit and like a couple quips in the background. You know what I mean? That's a lot. It's like, it's not even really a hangout movie. It's almost like a concert movie. But then you get to see the behind the scenes of the concerts, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, it's not a traditional narrative by any stretch of the imagination. Like, the thing is, you have the political thing where you have the, like, the guy running for president with the blowhorn, like, driving around town and stuff like that.
Let us know if that actually occurred in your town at any point in time when you were growing up, because I don't remember that ever happening, and I feel like it was just a movie trope. But maybe that's kind of a small town thing that happened back in the day, but I feel like that shit is in like Back to the Future or something. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I've seen that in a bunch of movies, but like, I don't know. Do you remember some fucking congressman driving around your town fucking shouting at people in a van?
I don't remember that in my childhood.
Was it Justin Teen Wolf?
Might have been Justin Teen Wolf. I never heard it as a kid, but like, since I moved here, I've definitely had like politicians and weird like religious things drive through neighborhoods.
Yeah,
and
true.
Heard that shit. So,
true.
I mean, maybe it's always happened, but it wasn't a thing from my childhood. You've been to Nashville, haven't you? Like the actual physical place.
I've been to Nashville many times, actually. There's a club that I played at in Nashville like at least five times. It's just kind of like in the same way, I don't know, just kind of in the same way of like you either play like the Charm City Art Space or the Auto Bar.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, this was like that place in Nashville. And I feel like I recently heard that it wasn't there anymore, but it's like maybe the front of it was like a pizza shop and kind of a, I feel like maybe they sold alcohol there. I don't know. And then like a venue in the back, but they were like arcade games and shit. I don't know. It's a cool, weird place. I don't know. I don't remember what it's called, but yeah, I've been there a bunch of times, and I've been to like the kind of the strip where like all the country shit is. But like even like in the early 2000s when I first went there, it was kind of like, you know, back when I was like really into like Lucero and Wilco and Drive By, then I was like getting on my fucking country vibe. I couldn't find much that I liked about Nashville in that way.
I mean, it makes sense. I think it's, I feel like in some ways, like there's two perceptions of Nashville. Mm-hmm. I haven't been there since I was a kid, so it's been forever.
Yeah.
And like, I guess one is like Nashville is kind of like Austin, which I've also never been to.
Yeah.
But the more country fried and less hipster version.
Mm-hmm.
Or like, it's just like a row of like, you know, there's music studios and there's bars and venues and shit like that where people trying to live their dreams kind of thing.
I think what I thought of Nashville when I was there was like, oh, this place has just been dead a while. It's just like Nashville's time is fucking come and gone. I'm sorry. Like, yes, country music is still big, but like country music is rap music now. And country music is trap music now.
No, and that's, you know, that's actually true. But I also know like there's a lot of recording studios, and then like, you know, in the 90s, a lot of like alternative rock bands.
Yeah.
Like when we're, you know,
so now it's just another music town.
Yeah.
Rather than, it's thought of as just a music town rather than just a country place. Rather than just the Grand Ole Opry.
Yeah, I mean, I went there as a kid and I saw the Osborne Brothers play.
Yeah.
Big bluegrass band. Like
the Osbournes.
No.
Or not the Osborne. What am I thinking? The Jonas Brothers. Okay. I'm thinking of something completely different. I just saw the fucking,
I don't think any of those any Jonas brother can fucking shred on a mandolin.
Right on.
Maybe not. I don't know. But I remember doing that, and I don't think it's in Nashville, but it's on that, I don't know where exactly it is, but my, you know, there's a picture of my mom and I when I was a kid at Loretta Lynn's house, like her like mansion, plantation, or whatever the fuck she lived at.
Yeah.
And I know it's like close to Pigeon Forge. I don't know where Pigeon Forge is in relative to Nashville.
I feel like it's close to Knoxville.
Might be closer to Knoxville, because like,
it's definitely like very, it's like Pigeon Forge is like way on the east side, whereas like Memphis is way west.
Memphis or Nashville?
Memphis is like way over here. Pigeon Forge is way over here. And then I feel like Nashville is like somewhere kind of in between.
Yeah. And I've also been
south of it.
Yeah. I kind of want to go back.
Yeah.
Just because, like, you know, kind of do something different, just visit somewhere else. I mean, I remember going to Dollywood as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
like, I would like to go back. But I know this is all, we're getting way off topic here, other than, like, it's all country fried here. I don't know, because, like, the one thing I like about this movie, it felt like Nashville was popping at all hours. Like, you could walk into any fucking honky-tonk, fucking dive bar, fucking restaurant, and you could hear a fucking sick-ass performer.
Country music is weird, man. Like, country music is another thing where, like, they're, in the 60s and 70s, for sure, there was, like, you started getting waves of, you know, things that are then, because it got commercialized. Mm-hmm. So then there are people that, like, thought that they were, like, whether they were, like, popular or not, you know, they're the real deal. And then, like, here's this new thing. And it's like, it's weird little things that the average listener wouldn't even pick up on. They're just like, yeah, man, they started putting strings in their songs in fucking 1968. Yeah. You know what I mean? And then, like, a motherfucker will be mad about that shit.
Well, no, it's kind of what happened with bluegrass, because for a while, like, speaking of Osborne Brothers, they were one of the first bluegrass, like, bands that actually fucking plugged in and, like, did, like, amplified, like, electric fucking banjo mm-hmm. and mandolin and all that shit.
Yeah.
And actually had a fucking drummer.
Right on.
Like, that was kind of considered blasphemous.
Right. It's like when Bob Dylan went electric and they fucking yelled Judas at him.
Yeah, fucking Pete Singer, Pete Seeger swinging an axe at, well, it wasn't an axe at him, but he's trying to cut the fucking power.
How do we get to this portion of the conversation?
Because the thing is like, we could talk about performances, mm-hmm. we could talk about the scenes or whatever, but I feel like what Nashville really is just a vibe. And I hate using that term, but, like, yeah. I don't have a better description of it than it's just, like...
Well, it's... Like, see, the thing about it is, right, like, it's just, it just so accurately portrays, not that I was fucking there, man, but, like, it feels then like it just so accurately portrays the time period that it literally existed and was made in, but it's just so, I don't know. The thing that makes it great, again, is that in the way that it's, like, you can't tell if it's fucking parody or not.
Yeah.
You know, it's so genuine and just feel, it does feel more, it feels more like a genuine homage than a parody, really. But, like, you can't deny the fucking silliness of it all.
Yeah, I mean,
it's like, I don't know.
I mean, there's definitely quite a few jokes in there. Like, I think of Henry Gibson's character, who's, like, the more, like, kind of proud, like, super Nashville guy. He's wearing, like, kind of, mm-hmm. don't want to say the Elvis jumpsuit, but, like, definitely a kind of jumpsuit. Yeah. When he's recording that ultra fucking ridiculous patriotic song in the beginning, and then, like, gets fucked up at the end, they have to do another take and, like, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Like, obviously there's jokes in that. It's just like you're cross-cutting with that, with Lily Tomlin singing the gospel songs and all that. And then you go to those, like, bars and, like, you know, club. It's kind of hard to talk about performances, even though I think everyone in this movie knew the assignment and kind of fucking nailed it.
Yeah.
Like, even Jeff Goldblum, who doesn't have a single line of fucking dialogue in this movie. He's just riding his motorcycle around, showing up at gigs mm-hmm. or, like, performances, like, just kind of there hanging out. And it's like, you know, again, I don't like using the word vibe, but, like, it literally, this movie is a vibe. But then there's so many dangling threads. And then there's the one which has to do with the David Hayward character, the guy with the violin case,
mm-hmm.
which obviously leads to the climax, so to speak, which I kind of want to talk about. Like, well, should talk a little bit more about Ronnie Blakely, who probably most void audience members would know as the mom from the original Nightmare on Elm Street, Nancy's mom.
Mm-hmm.
But this was her debut, and she wasn't originally supposed to be, like, this high profile in the movie, but I forget who the actress was supposed to be in there, but, like, didn't work out, and, like, she had already done background vocals on some of the songs and had been help orchestrating, like, working behind the scenes on the music, and Robert Altman's like, fuck it, why don't you do it?
Hell yeah.
So she got a, you know, breakout role of it. And, like, you know, she's probably got the bigger arc out of everything because, like, you know, she's a big, you know, she's basically the template for Loretta Lynn or someone like that.
Right on.
And she's kind of having nervous breakdowns and all that. And, like, the whole focal point is at the end of the movie, like, this dude with a violin case where it's not a violin, it's like a gun, and she gets shot, like, martyr style.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, that's, like, the biggest thread. And you don't even know what that dude's motivation for it is. It's like, is it political? Is it like because, you know, wants his own 15 minutes of fame? Like, what is that?
Yeah.
And, I mean, with a lot of this movie, there's a lot of questions that don't get answered.
True.
Very much. And that's kind of one of them. Because, like, you know, I feel like if a scene like that happened now in a movie, and probably with good reason, like, you know, there would be the shooting and then, like, there would be all the decompression of it and, like, people being sad and broken. After all this, people just start singing.
Mm-hmm.
And just, like, kind of keep up and, like, let's heal through music kind of thing. Which, you know, obviously probably wouldn't happen now in any kind of movie that dealt with, like, you know, lone gunman, active shooter kind of thing. Another thing I want to bring up, speaking of the assassination subplot, is that when John Lennon was assassinated, people start coming after this movie in particular and Robert Altman, saying, like, you create planted seeds and you're inspired. And Altman's answer to that was, like, bullshit. I was warning you of, like, where things were headed in the world climate-wise, and no one bothered to listen. Like, this wasn't me, like, you know, trying to endorse this kind of shit. This is just like, this is going to be the shit that's going to happen with the way the world's going.
I feel like the John Hinckley Reagan assassination attempt is a little more apt comparison.
It is. I mean, but
I guess that was just the first one.
Yeah, but you also got Taxi Driver, which, like, because there was that baggage with him, like, being obsessed with Jodie Foster and all that.
True.
So, but honestly, it's kind of in the same vein.
Yeah.
Like, you know, let's be real. It's like, you know, I don't know. You know, obviously, John Hinckley had seen Taxi Driver. Who's to say he didn't see Nashville, too?
True.
So, I don't know. I mean, I don't think he has a letterbox. He's on Twitter. I mean, he might be one of the few people now who doesn't have a letterbox, but, like,
catch him when he's in town on tour and ask him.
I forgot he's doing that. But, yeah. I mean, actually, maybe
new record out on Sacred Bones by the end of 2024.
Dude. I know you're joking, but, like,
somebody would do it.
Someone's going to do it, you know. I mean, because Hinckley, what was the guy? Mark David Chapman. He was the guy that killed John Lennon, right?
Yeah.
Like, he, you know, because he actually did it, you know, Hinckley only was attempted, and it was Ronald Reagan. And a lot of people didn't like Ronald Reagan.
Yeah.
So maybe that's the difference. You know, John Lennon was an iconic musician. Ronald Reagan was a politician.
Iconic actor.
You know, it wasn't. He was a subpar actor, son. Like, he was not a great actor. He was C-tier.
Right on.
It's like, win one for the Gipper. That's all. That was his fucking catchphrase for whatever fucking movie that was from. I don't know. We're getting way sidetracked here.
Who's your modern day equivalent
to Ronald Reagan?
As far as if an actor from that long ago became president now, meaning if you think about the time span from the last time anyone gave a shit about Ronald Reagan, this is an insane question. The last time someone gave a shit about, like, Ronald Reagan's, like, heyday of acting, okay? And then he became president in the 80s, right? So, like, you know, how many years is that?
I see his last acting role was I'm trying to think of his late 60s or 70s, was the Killers, the Don Siegel version of it.
So I'd say 12 years. So 12 years ago.
Well, yeah, because he also ran for governor of California and, like, I'm trying to remember when The Killers came out, because it was right after he did that movie. He got acting, got into politics, and he really hated that movie because he slapped around Andy Dickinson in The Killers.
Okay, so, but anyway, but so. Yeah.
So you're
so if there was an actor from 12 years ago that's like a C-list actor that would become president, who would the modern day equivalent be?
It's kind of hard. And I don't consider him C-list. But I think he's probably C-list now because of, you know, what's happened. Like, maybe James Woods.
Okay.
But I think
you're not adhering to the rules at all, but that's fine.
Well, I'm trying to think of someone that would, like, who is, like, it would be like.
I think James Woods is a household name.
I know, and that's why I hate saying it, but, like, I'm also.
I'll, too, go further than 12 years ago and go Seth Green.
think Seth Green? I mean,
I don't like it. I don't like him as president. This is the dumbest thing ever. This is not on the podcast.
No, we're leaving. This is
just really stupid.
No, we're leaving it because it's just.
Now, Paul Walker is who I'd go with. So you're going. You're actually going political. I'm not. I'm just choosing the guy.
Yeah, but was Paul Walker?
It doesn't make any. It doesn't make any sense.
But he wasn't C-tier. He was in those Fast and Furious movies, dog.
Also a household name.
Also not alive.
Makes it funnier.
I think he's too big. It's probably the fucking Rock, Dwayne Johnson,
the guy that's actually going to be president.
Yeah.
Fuck, man. Yeah, dude. It took us way too long to get to that conclusion, which is funny that that's actually took way too long. Okay, here we go. We're back.
We're back. You know, that's our sidebar of like. It's the fucking Rock.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah. I don't think the Rock has ever done a country song, but you know, I don't even think he had a country gimmick. Imagine if he did. Anyway, actually a lot of the country gimmicks never worked in wrestling, but whatever, you know. Yeah, where the fuck are we even going with any of this? I like how we were like, we're talking about Nashville and we talk about everything but the movie and just all the things that kind of go into it, which I feel like is the best way to talk about this movie, really.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I do want to talk about one scene that kind of struck me as we were when I was rewatching it and you were watching first time, is the scene where Keith Carradine is singing I'm Easy.
Mm-hmm.
And like, there's a room full of women that he's obviously been with.
Yeah.
Or wanted to be with. And they're all looking at him like, oh, he wrote this song for me.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I need to be with him now. This song's about me. This has really got me. And like, the way Altman does it, because like the person that seems least likely is the Lily Tomlin character, because she's further in the back of the room.
Yeah.
She's way back. And you kind of hit around all the other people and just like, well, I mean, I guess the intent is the song is about her.
Yeah.
But it's just the way he delivers it. I do want to talk about just like the kind of direction, because, you know, Altman like zooms, he likes loose camera work. I mean, the movie shot scope, but it's just like, there's a lot of neat framing and setup, but like it's also just feels like it's loose enough that he's there to capture something that may mm-hmm. not be planned.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's the thing I like about Altman in general. I don't know. I feel like, I don't know what else to say about this movie. I like this movie a lot, but I feel like it's also, again, it's a movie because there's so many characters, there's so many things going on. I just feel like the only thing I talk about is just like how it makes me feel. Like watching Nashville just on a surface level makes me wish I was there.
Yeah.
And going to those bars, going to those clubs, going to the Grand Ole fucking Opry
mm-hmm.
and just fucking vibing and enjoying it. That's my big takeaway from like Nashville.
Yeah, man.
So I don't know. Do you have a closing thought, or is that just the closing thought here?
Well, I'm just going back to what I was saying earlier about like kind of the different levels of country music. And like, so, you know, when you even talk about the country artists that got upset at the time, it's like, what are we talking? Pop country? Are we talking, I don't know. It's just like, who are the people kind of critiquing it at the time? And I'm curious, but I'm also curious at the same time, like kind of like which Nashville he was going after at the time, if you know what I'm saying, because like it being such an industry, it changes over the years. And so like he was actually parodying, like this was supposed to be Tanya Tucker, this is supposed to be this guy.
It was supposed to be exact, but I think mm-hmm. there were the influence on it.
Yeah.
And like, if you look at how like everyone who's played in the movie, you get it. Like, there's the Keith Carradine and like the other two people were like a Peter Paul Mary type fucking
sure, totally.
Folk rock band. Mm-hmm. So it was also touching on the folk aspect of it.
Yeah,
and like, you know, it feels like it was probably mainstream Nashville. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I'm not saying Loretta Lynn was like the most mainstream thing, but she was huge as shit. And but you know what's not in there. Mm-hmm. is like all the outlaw country stuff. You don't have Johnny Cash or Waylon Jennings or Willie Nelson or Kris Kristofferson.
Yeah.
Like, you don't have that kind of archetypes in there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's like absent, but it's probably because those guys were also kind of, I don't want to say on the outskirts, but like, you know, they weren't really part of that. because they were doing their own thing.
Right on.
And I think also Outlaw Country was more in tune with, like, you know, let's play a little rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
Let's dip our toes in, you know, different genres of music. Let's be collaborative with other artists, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas, like, I feel like the Nashville Altman was looking at in the specific movie are the, like, it's basically the Nashville establishment.
Yeah.
And a certain thing in a certain way. Because you also got to think, like, I don't think people in Nashville really liked the outlaw country at the time either.
Totally.
So, which is probably why that wasn't included, because, like, that was on the outskirts, even though that stuff was probably just as big, if not bigger, at different times, you know? But that's interesting that that was not part of it. I just feel like he's not really parroting it. It's not really a satire, but I think it's just because everything is so on the nose, and, like, there's a fundamental understanding of what that town is, how it operates.
Right. I feel like it's not satire, but at the same time, it's not too many steps away from being fucking Spinal Tap or Mighty Wind or that sort of thing, where it's kind of authentically showing what a lot of those bands were really like, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, that's is what metal really is like. That, you know what I'm saying? Like, folk music really is that fucking funny if you look at it on a personal level like that, you know?
But I think what separates it from a Mighty Wind or even Spinal Tap is that, you know, let's be real. The songs in Spinal Tap are jokes.
Yeah, but
they're well done jokes. But totally. Like, but the lyrics give away of, right, like, right, the absurdity. Right, totally.
But I guess it also. But I'm saying that all three, not like Nashville included, with Spinal Tap and Mighty Wind, to make my point, is that they're all showing how, like, man, all these people have, like, created this persona. Like, you know what I mean? Like, they aren't real people. They're people that have become these people, sure, mm-hmm. Which makes them real people, right? But, like, you know, to be any type of star in that capacity, like, you end up becoming just a parody of yourself, even. And you know, you're not real anymore, and you're just kind of feeding the monster, you know?
No, and that's perfectly acceptable. Another, I might have actually said this when I did a Q&A with Mike Cuenca back in the pandemic, when he had his movie I'll Be Around, which mm-hmm. was like a two-part movie, which is, I think, or maybe it released as one part now. I know at one point it was like two different movies. Now it's one movie or something like
that. Yeah, it's like side A, side B.
But, you know, there's some parallels to that in Nashville, except it's more like, because I was thinking of, like, how do you transpose something like Nashville onto something more modern? And then just like, oh shit, Mike kind of tapped in that movie. I just it's weird to just all of a sudden think about it, but it's like, you know, Mike kind of tapped in, like, there's lots of characters, there's totally. Lots of threads. But I also think, like, Mike might have had more of a focus than, like, this was, because this is, like, definitely just, like, loose.
It's quite loose. Again, I'm quite happy that it does come together at the end, because it reeled me back in, man.
And, you know, I feel like, you know, Altman did this throughout his career, you know, to varying degrees of success. But I feel like when he was during his, like, second wind comeback, in a way,
mm-hmm.
when, you know, I'm talking about The Player and Shortcuts and, like, that cool. era, like, those movies operate in the same spectrum, but, like, I feel like they're just a little bit more tighter, and probably because Altman was able to adapt his style to the modern era.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I feel like this is a really good time capsule movie on top of that. Just, you know, it's not going to be for everyone. Robert Altman's not for everyone, but, like, if you can just get into it, and, like, you know, I'll be curious if you ever sit down and watch this again, like, what your takeaway will be. Because you know the twist,
right?
You know, like, I'm making it sound like an M. Night Shyamalan movie or something. But, like, but because you know where the payoff is, it's like, you know, how do you perceive and watch it from there and out? Because every time I watch it, for different threads. Because, like, you know, something that I might be interested in at one point in my life might be different on the next time I view it, and I may be focusing on this thread in particular, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's at least my thoughts on Nashville. What would you rate this on Letterboxd?
I probably 4.
4? I think it's fair. I give it a 5.
Yeah, it looks like most of the homies are giving it a 5, And I get why. And I may come around in subsequent viewings, but right now I'm comfortable with four. I understand why it's important. And again, I mean, you know, the ending is kind of tailor-made for me. I mean, let's be real here. Yeah. I mean, so it's that really just pulled everything together, and it's pretty fucking sick, man.
Yeah.
I'm a fan. And I love the country music aspect of it too. Like, it's, you know, I can't think of I can't think of another film that like brings that vibe that hard, where it isn't a full on joke, or it isn't like, sure, there are things that take place in that era and whatever, but like, you know, if you're just like, in fact, I'll tell you, I'll be straight up here. So like the week before we watched this, I even kind of purposely, like, I've been listening to a bunch of country music lately and stuff like that. I've been trying to get into the mood. And then I still watched it and was like, I don't think I like this. but you know, I've been fucking vibing with it. I've been playing Red Dead Redemption 2, you know,
getting that old West vibe.
But yeah, I can't really think of any other films that really take you to Nashville like this motherfucker does.
I mean, you know, a couple other things I'll say before we just wrap. Like, apparently the movie was longer at one point that they talked about releasing as a 2-part movie, like, you know, Kill Bill 1 and 2 style.
Damn.
Where it'd be like Nashville Red and Nashville Blue. Allegedly,
oh wow!
Allegedly, and Robert Altman eventually dismissed this as that wasn't true. He said, like, basically anything that was usable was in the movie. Mm-hmm. That there was enough footage and enough like kind of performance stuff that like they could do a whole mini series.
Damn!
But Altman said like most of the stuff that didn't go in the movie was just musical performances. It wasn't like all the narrative threads are in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So,
you know, he did do that TV series in the, was it in the 90s or was it late 80s?
Which one?
It's like Tucker fucking something. It's like a presidential race.
Oh, you mean, yeah. What the fuck is that called? Fuck. It's actually pretty good. It was on HBO.
Yeah.
It was during his like kind of TV phase, which is also, you know, Altman made a lot of stuff. What is that fucking called? Because it was written by the guy who did Doonesbury, the comic strip.
Okay.
What is that called? Fuck. I hate when it's... I almost said Secret Honor, which is the movie he did with
right,
which is a TV movie where Philip Baker Hall played Nixon,
mm-hmm.
which was the movie that was the reason why Paul Thomas Anderson cast him in Sydney, aka Hard Eight. Hold on, what is this?
Okay,
because I actually own this fucking Criterion disc, and now I'm just blanking on what it is. Tanner 88.
Tanner 88. I said Turner, so I was damn close.
You're damn close. And I was like, I know it wasn't Turner. I just couldn't think. Yeah, it's a good miniseries. And like, I think at one point they talked about doing a sequel of Nashville with most of the principal players again, like 12 years later. Cool. Never happened. But, I mean, maybe it's for the best. It's like, I don't think Altman was really a sequel guy because he didn't make any sequels to anything else, you know? Basically, Altman would just tackle a different genre, a different style movie in that Altman style.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. Yeah, so that's going to wrap up our discussion of Nashville. Yeah, let us know on the social media what you think of Nashville. Is it one of your favorite Altmans? Do you like Robert Altman? Do you like country music? Have you been to Nashville? Do you like Nashville? You know, just, you know, we're here for the film discussion because, you know, it's cool that Nick and I get to do a podcast and talk about things, but we want to hear from you as well. So, yeah, let us know your thoughts on Nashville and our discussion on it. But we're going to take one last commercial break, and when we return, it's going to be Read, Watch, and Listen here on the Cinematic Void Podcast.
Robert Altman's Nashville is 5 days in the lives of 24 unforgettable people. That's a lot of characters, so listen closely. Lily Tomlin is a gospel singer who strays just a bit when she has a one-night stand with Keith Carradine, a hot young rock singer. Ned Beatty is her husband who doesn't suspect a thing.
Henry Gibson is the number one country and western singer who's being tempted to run for governor. His sidekick, Barbara Baxley, drinks a bit and talks a lot. And his son, Dave Peel, is sort of attracted to Geraldine Chaplin, who plays a starstruck reporter from BBC TV.
Ronnie Blakely is the adored singing star on the verge of a breakdown. Alan Garfield is the husband trying to save her life and her career. Scott Glenn is the quiet soldier who worships her from afar. Karen Black is the rival singer who dresses like a sweet little prom queen. But don't let that fool you.
Michael Murphy is the campaign manager who'll promise anything, especially to Gwen Wells, a waitress who dreams of being in the spotlight and may have to do a lot of things she never dreamed of to get there. Robert Doakey is the one man who tries to tell her the truth.
Shelley Duvall is the wide-eyed groupie doing what all groupies do so well. Keenan Wynn is the uncle who doesn't understand this wild girl in the sequined hot pants. David Hayward is the sensitive young boy who answers the room for rent sign and who has a big surprise in store for everyone.
Christina Raines is the female singer in a trio who's married to one of them, Alan Nichols, but spends a lot of time with the other one. And David Arkin is the chauffeur who knows all the inside stories and is ready to tell them.
Timothy Brown is a black singer who's made it, but not everybody is happy about that. Jeff Goldblum is the cycle freak who's everywhere the action is. Barbara Harris is the would-be superstar who's running away from husband Burt Remsen, who's chasing her through the wilds of Nashville.
Nashville is about a lot of things and a lot of people. See all 24 of them and the outrageous things they do in Robert Altman's Nashville.
Robert Altman's Nashville.
For movie lovers.
The damnedest thing you ever saw.
Welcome back. It's now time for... Watch. On the Cinematic Void podcast, where we talk about all the things we've been reading, watching, and or listening to since the last time we recorded a podcast. All right, Nick, why don't you tell me what you've been reading, watching, and or listening to?
I don't know, Jim. Stop asking me questions. My brain is broken.
And that wraps up this
this like Instagram page I follow that sells like they'll sell like fucking actual like pencil drawings that like Charles Manson did, or like that's not something they actually have, but like they have like the fucking, they have like contractor papers from Israel Keyes because he was like a home contractor when he was like a serial killer or whatever. But they have shit like that. So they have like straight up like real like serial killer collectible shit. Then they posted, they had these zines that I was looking for called Murder Can Be Fun. Like I found like one or two of them years ago, but it's like this zine from the '90s. Like for instance, there's like there's a issue that like the entire thing is just stories of like people getting fucking killed at the zoo.
Really?
You know, shit like that. And so, and then there's like, you know, one of them is like fucking, you know, mailmen going postal being from the '90s.
Yeah.
They actually like are pre like Columbine, but they're just insane zines that are like, again, they're pretty old at this point. So they're kind of fucking pricey too, man. But I keep my eye out for them. And I saw that this, I think it's like True Cult Collectibles or something, but that they were selling like a fucking lot of them. So I just like instantly fucking snatched them up. So I've been reading those guys. They're fun as hell. I'm trying to collect them all. There's probably like 20 of them in all. It would be sick to have like a coffee table book that collects all of them. Like, man, I wish I could pull something like that together.
Who originally put them out though?
I mean, some fucking rando dude. You know what I mean? They're just papered fucking Xeroxed zines from the 90s.
I mean, did that dude just disappear?
I did very quick research and found nothing, but like I didn't really try to dig at all. But I don't know, man. I wish I could be the publisher.
Yeah. I mean, Paranoid Futures Publishing.
Man, how cool would that be to fucking put that out? But
that guy's got to be out there somewhere.
It's got to be out there somewhere, man. Fucking A. Yeah. I mean, shit like that. Things like that make me wonder, like, what the fuck else is out there? Like, I kind of came across that, you know? Just like, what other kind of weird-ass zines and shit are floating around from the 90s that I would absolutely love that are just weird as hell? And I've just, you know, they're just lost to time. There's so much cool literature like that out there that's just like, damn, man.
I know there's certain places that have zine libraries. I don't know if those would particularly end up in there because of probably the weird collectible nature of some of those zines.
Sure.
But I'm kind of curious about it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, as someone that's like started doing pretty much a zine again, you know, with the Cinematic Void zine, I, you know, there's a few places that are kind of doing them again, but they're all really, you know, I think the Void zine looks nice. Shout out to Eagle Barber, does the designing on it.
Yeah.
And like, you know, full color printing and stuff like that. But like, you know, I feel like a lot of the zines and like kind of like mini books that are coming out now are really, really nice. And, but like, there's something about the 90s.
Totally.
That just, right. You know, we've talked a lot about the 90s. We talked about the 70s and we talked about the 90s.
Yeah.
On this podcast a lot. There's something about like zines from the 90s. They're just like, you know, you go to fucking Staples and you when they used to be on the honor system while making copies.
Yeah.
Not anymore, but like, you know, the fact that like those things exist and that's the only way they ever existed.
Zines were the podcast of the 90s. Everybody had a zine, so like,
yeah.
So I'm just saying there's a lot out there. So who even know, it's just like independent publishing. Like there's definitely bound to be so much cool weird shit out there. Like fuck, man. It's just, yeah. You had a zine actually in the 90s that I for sure still have copies of around.
Yeah, it was actually a comic, which, you know, there was a lot of zine comic stuff. It was Jerry the Stupid Kid. You might have might be one of the only people that actually own like original printed copies. Yeah, I
love this thing.
I have, because there's only two issues that actually got photocopied and done. I have the original like pieces, you know, mm-hmm. But like, I think there was a third one I started, never got done, but like, it's cool. You still have those. So yeah.
Hell yeah.
I mean, they're pretty embarrassing. Well, they're not embarrassing. They're written by a fucking 15-year-old kid.
Right on. Yeah.
So they're going to be juvenile. I don't know. I mean, yeah. The comic was called Jerry the Stupid Kid. The whole premise was he would do something stupid and then fucking blow up.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's fucking art right there.
It was definitely a drawing of you.
I mean, it was me. It's, you know, that was myself.
you're Jerry.
I am Jerry. And I do some stupid shit a lot. So
hell yeah.
You know, it's sometimes zines are, you know, you're tapping into the truth. Anyway, back to your rewatch and listen.
I just watched the Steven Soderbergh Solaris. Pretty cool.
I actually dig that one.
Yeah, yeah, I thought it was really cool.
Do you have it on DVD, Blu-ray, or you just watch it on
screen? No, I just watch it streaming.
If you get a chance.
I think it's actually on Criterion Channel right now.
I don't know if Criterion does the commentaries?
Maybe not on this one.
If you get a chance, watch the commentary with Steven Soderbergh and James Cameron.
Okay.
Because James Cameron was a producer on it. And it's like, it's one of the best like filmmaker talk shop commentaries out there.
No shit.
Actually, it's worth listening to any Steven Soderbergh commentary. Because cool. Like he's one of the great filmmakers. And like he has such insight even on the movies of his that he feels like are failures. He'll talk a lot of game. I mean, obviously there's like Schizopolis where he does a Q&A with himself.
That never pans out.
No, that it works.
No shit. Okay.
I mean, you have to watch Schizopolis because like he's,
yeah, okay,
because he's the director and he's acting in it and all that. But like,
oh, interesting.
Yeah, like I think all those Soderberghs are eventually coming back out again. But like, I feel like I keep hijacking your shit. But like, I actually like that Solaris remake. No, okay. But like, yeah,
good shit. I just watched My Dinner with Andre, another Louis Malle. With homie from Princess Bride, what's his damn name? Sean Patrick Scott.
Oh, what's his fucking
William name? He's got three names.
Oh, what is that dude's name?
Sean Patrick. I'm just saying words.
The guy for, I know the,
you know, George Mason Dixon.
The fucking inconceivable guy.
Yeah.
What is his actual name? God damn it. Like
William,
just making up fucking names.
William Morris Scott.
What is his actual name? It's fucking Wallace Shawn.
He doesn't have three names at all.
Wallace Shawn.
I just watched My Dinner. I just watched My Dinner with Andre, the Louis Malle. My Dinner with Andre is definitely just a Wallace Shawn and another man sitting down at dinner, Andre himself, and just talking for an hour and a half. It's one of those. I've got a list on Letterboxd of those as well.
Of just people sitting around eating and talking?
Just like a film that takes place in like one room with just like heavy dialogue or whatever, you know?
I mean, you do like a lot of Mammoth.
True. True. So just watch that. Good shit. Just watch Them Come Blood again. The Mike Cuenca, also mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
One of his like 15 new films, but he just did like a test screening at LF3, so I ran it for him. So we actually watched it like, so I actually got to see it on the big screen.
Yeah. Last time I saw it was like when we were there for the, it was me, you, and Kevin Kalash, who did co-director of Starry Eyes. Was there something, it was like someone else was there, or was it just us three?
I think it was us three.
Yeah, and like, you know, we gave some notes, and like, I
mean, Mike was there.
Oh yeah, well, Of course he was. He made the movie.
So it was four.
And I think Joaquin was there too.
Okay.
Whatever. I kind of want to see it again. I'm not trying to be dismissive. I did want to see
it. And I think blah, blah, blah was there. And but yeah, it was cool. The new edit. The new edit's really cool. It's not, I think he still has some like, I don't know. I mean, I don't want to talk about what he's got to, it's not done yet, but, yeah, I like the new edit a lot. So stoked for all of these to come out, man. I like what Mike does.
Yeah. Cause we're both in like 15 or out of the 15, we're in like two or three of them apiece. There's one where we're in a scene together. Actually,
this one, I'm two different characters in
this one. So. I think I'm in this one twice too.
I do like an Eddie Murphy thing where I play a number of characters.
I'm in this twice because I was the killer in one bit.
Yeah.
And then I play someone else, and then we're in it indirectly because of a band that I will not mention that will never come out is actually in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll just leave it at that.
I just watched Je t'aime. I can't remember who directed it or anything else, but you know. It's said to be a direct inspiration on, my brain is broken, dude. What am I talking about?
Hold on. I can't,
it was a big inspiration on, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, for sure. But it's more of like a time travel movie. Good shit. Just watch the documentary Burden about the artist Chris Burden, and to finish out, I just rewatched the Nick Mullen Year of the Dragon special that came out last year. This is a very good comedy special by Nick Mullen from the Come Town podcast. And listen, I've been listening to some country jams. Not really. I've been listening to, I've been listening to Richard and Linda Thompson's I Want to See the Bright Lights. It's definitely something that seems like would be like reissued by the Numero group or something. But yeah, good shit. A lot of David Allan Coe, Long-Haired Redneck, Mysterious Rhinestone Cowboy. I've still been listening to Squeeze a bunch. Fucking bunch of Fleetwood Mac. Germs GI is on streaming right now. Maybe it won't be forever. So fucking listen to that a million times, you know.
But what's the difference between that and like the discography? I'm just curious. Just
like the discography has like the song from Cruisin' on it. It has I don't know. There's like extra stuff. There's like the Forming single. Like that shit's not on fucking GI.
Is GI just the
It's the LP.
It's just
it was always kind of confusing because like in the 90s, the CD came out that was the discography and like kind of seemed like nothing else existed. You know what I mean? Okay. But it's like the same record cover.
Is it? But I thought GI was on it.
GI is just like GI, man.
But is GI on the discography or am I fucking?
Yeah, it's on there. All the songs are on there for sure.
Okay. So that's where I was getting at. Yeah, I mean, but you know, sometimes it's nice to listen to the actual like LP.
Yeah, but it's like,
in the context.
It's like the record. Yeah. It's fucking, I mean, a perfect fucking punk record.
I agree with that. I'm looking at it. I'm going to say the best, at least my favorite fucking, Germ song is in a Land of Treason. Mm-hmm. I think that's just it's the ultimate fucking banger.
Yeah,
straight up. Or not in a Land of Treason. I think Land of Treason. Sorry.
Yeah.
You knew what I meant. I know someone would be like, "Well, actually."
Oh God! Don't you fucking will actually me about the Germs. yeah, man. I've been reading. I've been watching. I've been listening. What have you been? Oh, you don't fucking remember?
No. Dog, how many things we forgot so far that we've had to look up?
What are you fucking... Where you been?
Where have I been? Well, reading. I had books and I was on a reading path and that's done. I haven't read recently.
We're fucking up, bro.
We are.
Years. For years.
We should just call this Watch and Listen. I mean, the read was always like, yeah, this will make us both read because like Now it's an obligation, but then, no, it doesn't work. See, watch, I'm just going to list a couple things that are, like, new to me watches, as opposed to, like, the things I've rewatched for Q&As and stuff like that.
Cool.
So, I watched this movie called The Collingswood Story, which was a found footage movie from the early 2000s. Watched it on a virtual date night with Leslie on Shudder. I missed it when it came out, but I was aware of it. Basically, this whole movie is, you know, the premise is you're watching it off of people's video chats from the early 2000s. Like, early fucking, I don't even think AOL Messenger had video chats, but, like,
yeah,
really early on video chats. That's the whole thing. And I know a lot of people like this movie. I think it aged itself out. Like, gotcha. when your main male protagonist is, like, wearing a backwards hat.
Yeah.
I just want to see him die.
Jim has a insane hatred of people who wear backwards hats.
I
can't apparently.
Do it, but I will say, so there's one angle of this guy that they show his bedroom, and he had two posters up, and the one you could see right away was fucking an ICP poster, and it's like, sick.
Yeah, it's like the type of guy that would wear a backwards hat.
I mean, he looks like I the jokes I were making as we were watching this.
Is it a fitted ball cap, or is it?
No, it wasn't fitted, dude. Yeah, it was just a backwards baseball cap. Yeah, yeah. I say this, actually, it might have been fitted now that I think about it.
Yeah.
But anyway, like, there was the ICP poster, and I was like, you know, this dude, like, definitely, like, listens to, like, oh, what was it, like, Drowning Pool or fucking something like that. And then there's another poster, and then, like, Leslie and I kept looking at it, and I'm like, oh, what is it? It's like, I bet you it's a Limp Bizkit poster. And I go and look up Limp Bizkit posters from, like, the late 90s, early 2000s. It was a fucking Limp Bizkit poster.
Hell yeah.
I was like, you know what? I take it back. This guy's sick.
Hell yeah.
But yeah, it's basically the premise is, like, these two friends that I guess are sort of, like, but not really romantically intertwined. Like, this girl's, like, staying at this place where, like, has this haunted history. And, you know, they could call up different people in video chat. And, like, some of it's, like, kind of like chat roulette.
Yeah.
And then there's a psychic that, like, you know, you're supposed to pay, and she'll do a psychic reading over the video chat. And I don't know. It also takes place on Halloween, because the dude with the backwards hat has a homie that, like, carves all these pumpkins, but it kind of implies, like, he fucked the pumpkins. Maybe not. Maybe I was just making up threads that don't exist. I think, like, the last 2 minutes of the movie are really, really fucking good. But, like, you know, if you're not in the mood to watch something on a video chat, sometimes they have the video chat player on the computer screen that you're looking at. So I guess they're trying to mix it up so that, like, you know, it's not, like, the same back and forth of a fucking screen.
Yeah.
But it's just, like, you know, interesting idea, but, like, I don't know. It didn't age well to me. I mean, I guess it didn't age well. I didn't see it at the time. Maybe if I saw it when it came out, I'd be like, yo, this is fucking sick. This guy's talking on a video chat, and he's got an ICP and a Limp Bizkit fucking poster. Even though I was never into any of those bands at that point.
Yeah.
We were probably actively making fun of people. Although, I will say, sure. In hindsight of years of being in bands, the nicest people I've met playing shows across the country have always been the dude or dudette in a fucking ICP shirt.
Yeah.
Like, straight up. They will buy merch. They will be super nice to you. So, I have nothing against ICP and Juggalos. Just stating that. Like, they are nice, kind people. And we should respect them. Except for this guy in this movie. He deserved to die, and he did. Also watched I Miss You, Hugs and Kisses, which was released by Severn Films. It's a Canadian kind of drama about a guy that, like, gets arrested for allegedly murdering his wife, and then it's kind of told flashbacks while he's in jail about how he got there. Has music by Howard Shore, you know, longtime Cronenberg collaborator.
Yeah.
I didn't dislike it, didn't love it. Thought it was interesting kind of thing. The one thing, when I logged this on Letterboxd, and I was, like, having to be looking at, like, most frequently watched actors.
Yeah.
I saw a bunch of people, like, who the fuck are these people? It was, like, there's, like, three or four people in this movie that were also in Stone Cold Dead, which
yeah,
had screened, like, basically a week before or 2 weeks before that I watched this. So it's like, oh, there's a bunch of people that were shared in this movie.
Hell yeah.
Like, a lot of connections. Like, I mean, that was the thing I thought was the coolest thing about it. It's not a bad movie, but maybe I was in the mood for it, but it was just like, it was cool, but I don't know. I sold the Blu-ray.
Right on.
Because I have this rule now, if I watch something and if I don't really love it or don't think I'm going to rewatch it in 5 years, in the sale pile. That is my new rule. I also recently, maybe not recently, whenever, I got the Vinegar Syndrome's Forgotten Jolly Volume 6 box set. And first thing I watched out of it was Death Carries a Cane, which I haven't been able to watch since, like, I'd say back in the early 2000s when I got, like, a German import DVD. Because I think this might be the first U.S. release on disc.
Okay.
So that there's some other things in there. There's Naked You Die and The Bloodstained Shadow. Bloodstained Shadow is an all-time great giallo. And although these aren't really the most forgotten of gialli, it's still a solid set, so whatever.
Yeah.
It's a good giallo. It's a good giallo box set. Watched a movie on Amazon Prime called Dark Harvest, which came out last year. It's about, I guess the way to describe it is sort of like a, I don't know, it's folk horror. It's like Pumpkinhead meets, like, dare I say, almost like Children of the Corn.
Okay.
In a weird way. Basically, every Halloween, this pumpkin deity thing comes to life, and all the male boys in the town have to go and try to kill it, and whoever kills it becomes, you know, wins for the year, and their family gets a new house, a check, a car, that kind of shit.
Yeah.
And it's directed by the guy I did on 30 Days a Night. Did you ever see 30 Days a Night? Vampire movie in Alaska?
Yeah.
Which I actually liked it when I saw it. I haven't revisited it since, but, like, kind of has a similar vibe. The one thing I didn't like about it was visuals looked a little too clean.
Okay.
But some of the CGI effects just kind of, like, yeah. But I think the premise and, like, the delivery for the most part kind of landed, so I kind of dug it. I mean, I wouldn't say it's, like, the greatest thing I've ever seen, but it was, like, it was enjoyable for, like, a newer horror movie.
Cool.
So, yeah. For Listen, it's been basically a lot of singles off of albums that are coming out soon. First one, One Step Closer, which is, they put out a record that I really loved and an EP that I really loved. They got a new album that's coming out this year. First song dropped, incidentally enough, on Leap Year, or Leap Day.
Oh.
It's called Leap Year. I like it, but I think the vocals might be a little too, like, how do I put this? Like, pop, like a strand of pop punk I'm not really into. Like, the clean vocals just feel like it's a different band.
Oh, really? So they're not doing the Title Fight thing anymore?
It's a little, it's not quite Title Fight. I don't, maybe we'll listen together and, like, kind of pinpoint it.
Yeah.
After a few listens, I still, like, I like the song, and maybe I'm just, like, getting used to the vocals, but, like, the first thing I heard was, like, the way the clean vocals were produced as opposed to, like, the previous releases were, like,
interesting.
I don't want to use the term mainstream, but I don't have a better word for it.
Okay.
I don't know how to explain it. Like, I'm, you know, I'm withholding judgment until I hear the full album. So, and maybe it's just like a, maybe it's, I think there's a little too many vocal effects on the clean parts. Like, there's a conscious effort to, like, make the clean parts super clean. Where previously, like, there, like, the Title Fight kind of, like, clean parts were, like, at least a little still gritty. You know? I don't know.
You think they got their band name from looking at the back of a Linkin Park record?
I would hope so.
Okay.
I mean, maybe. I kind of wonder that, too.
Or is it just a turn of phrase they used?
I mean, who else is using One Step Closer other than Linkin Park?
I don't know.
I mean, I guess we could ask them. They probably wouldn't get an answer, though.
Just tweet at them.
Yo, did you get your name from a Linkin Park song or, like, a lyric or whatever the fuck it was?
Like, as if everyone else hasn't already asked them that. You could probably just look on Twitter.
Yeah, I should. Anyway, also, there's a single by Conway the Machine and Joey Badass called Vertigo, which is fucking really good.
Right on.
Like a solid fucking little hip-hop banger.
Cool.
Nasty beat, good verses from both guys. I really dig it. It's probably the best, like, rap thing I've heard this year. Although I did put on a little bit of that Schoolboy Q record.
I was going to ask if you heard any of that.
I heard the Freddie Gibbs song. I listened to some of it. It's
cool.
It's I'd say a little avant-garde hip-hop wise.
Yeah.
But, like, I haven't really gotten into it, so I didn't want to put on a list. It's kind
I forget which track it was, but I listened to the one that was produced by Alchemist, and I thought it was pretty fucking sick.
Yeah, I need to give it more of a listen, which is why I didn't really officially include it, because I've just been kind of like tapping in a little bit. There's a single that Leslie sent to me by a band called I Am the Coffin called Houses and Homes, which is like kind of punky, kind of falls. It's not hardcore, but there's hardcore stuff in it. It's kind of the, you know what I mean? It's the weird, like, heavy alternative rock thing.
Okay.
That's kind of popping up. Like, they have some other albums and stuff, but, like, this song is just really fucking good and catchy.
Nice.
And the last thing I listened to was a new song off the forthcoming Witch Vomit record, the new one. I think this is going to be their first real full length, because everything else has been kind of extended EPs at this point. Song is called Blood of Abomination. It has some kind of sick little melodic, like, Carcass Iron Maiden riff going on in it. Kind of dug it.
Nice.
Liked it a lot.
There's a new Spectre Voice song that came out a few weeks ago. Like, there's some, like, new death metal records that have been popping up that I'm like, oh, yeah, I should probably... Can't wait till the next time I'm in the mood to listen to death metal. I'll definitely check this out. I'm just, like, listen to country music instead, but, you know.
I mean, I kind of been just all over the place. Like, I haven't had, like, a solid, like, what I'm in the mood of, or what I'm in the mood for, I should say. So it's kind of nice. You get, like, you know, a lot of hardcore punk. You get, like, a fucking grimy rap song. You get, like, a kind of a rocking, like, hardcore Jason indie rock type thing. And then you get some death metal. So, yeah, variety is the spice of life. Although, that's the only spice I like, because I'm not going to go see Dune 2.
There it is.
There it is. You were waiting for the Dune hate.
I'm here for it.
Oh, I mean, fuck, dude. If you guys like Dune and Dune 2, whatever, Dune 1, Dune 2, I don't know if they have subtitles or other titles, but I don't know. I see everyone's like, Dune, greatest thing ever. And it's like, dog, I don't want to watch a movie with worms and fucking spice. I don't want to read a book about worms and fucking spice. David Lynch didn't even want to make a movie about worms and fucking spice, and he regretted it after he did it. Maybe he didn't regret it. Because he did that, he got to do Blue Velvet. But anyway, I don't know. That's just my Dune discourse. I'm a fucking Dune hater. Although, you're not shocked by this.
Not at all.
And most of you shouldn't be shocked by it. Anyway, so that's going to wrap up this edition of the Cinematic Void podcast. You know, tell us what you think. What's your opinions? Unless you want to talk about Dune. I don't want to talk about Dune, so don't send those opinions. But, you know, if you want to talk about, like, what have you been listening to? What have you been reading? That kind of stuff. Or, you know, your thoughts on Nashville or any of the other things we said in this podcast that I can't even remember. I guess we talked about screenings and the chase and things like that. Yeah, just let's have a social discourse. Except about Dune. I don't want to talk about Dune. So until next time, see you in the void.
Hey, gonna get you some lemonade. Mama. Oh, you're fine, darling. Fine. It's the microphone. Give me the mic.
I ain't done.
Oh, I know.
I ain't done.
Go get some glass of water. Come on, boys, help her off. All right, you'll come back. Okay, darling.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. All right.